Hello and welcome back to the Raspberry 8 podcast. Today I am joined by the most legendary figure in British judo. It is, of course, Neil Adams. Neil is the most decorated British judo competitor of all time, a two-time Olympic silver medalist, a world champion, a European champion, just had an unbelievable competition career. After retiring from competition, continued to work within judo as a coach, helping the sport grow in the UK massively. Even nowadays, in his mid-60s, he is continuing to train, coach, and is known as the voice of judo, as he is the main judo commentator for all of the biggest competitions around the world. Neil has been a dream guest of mine for many, many years for this podcast. I reached out to him and he graciously accepted. It was fantastic to meet him and his wife, Nikki, who showed me a huge amount of hospitality. Really had a great day spending time with them kicking my butt a little bit on the judo mats, and then having this fantastic conversation where we cover a whole range of stuff from Neil's early judo days, competition, training in Japan, all around the world, commentary, his first brush with Brazilian jiu-jitsu, as you know, Neil was always known as a real, really good with the niwaza, with the judo grappling. So it was a really interesting conversation to hear his thoughts and opinions on Brazilian jiu-jitsu as well. So I thoroughly enjoyed recording it, and I hope you guys enjoy listening. Check it out. So firstly, I just want to say what a massive honor it is to sit down and chat to you. You're someone that I've wanted to have on the podcast since I started it. I've been privileged to have a lot of great judokas on the podcast. So finally able to get the greatest judoka that the country has ever produced. I think statistically we can say that. So I just want to start by saying thank you very much for joining me.
It's an absolute pleasure. Absolute pleasure. Yeah, can't wait. See what comes from it.
Absolutely. So, you know, what I like to do with these podcasts, a lot of the time there, you know, I have podcasts with people who maybe aren't quite as well known as you. And I like to start at the beginning of the journey. I'm sure you've spoken about your judo journey plenty. But if we can just start with how you got into, you know, your first experience. Did you come from a judo family or judo background?
Well, my dad, he's a cyclist. My father was a cyclist, and he was he did judo just by accident. Quite fancied something a little bit different. Went to the local co-op in Rugby, and they had a little club there, and so he got into it, and then decided that he was going to introduce his two boys to judo. And so we went to a little club, Bilton, which is just on the outskirts of Rugby. And I remember it's just a little blue hut. We went there, and I can still remember him driving us up there. And there was a guy there called Johnny Farkosh, who was like, you know, it was this, he was jiu-jitsu, judo. He was a judo guru at the time in Rugby. And he was going to introduces to judo. So I remember doing front break falls and back break falls, and I had this little blazer on that, it was just an old school blazer, and it was a tie around it, and that's how I started judo. And it was just a year doing it at this little club, and then I moved from there to Coventry Judo Club, which was my home then for many years.
So how old were you when you first got introduced to judo?
I was 7. My brother was about 10. Yeah. And so we like I say, it started off just really to try a sport that was individual, because I was heavily into my football. I love soccer, and I played soccer, a lot of soccer at the time. And so my dad wanted us to do this sport that was individual, and just took to it. I absolutely loved it, because that was my, I think that we've introduced our kids as well to team events, and we've introduced them to individual. And, my son is a great team man. He loved, you know, he was great with the rugby, and my daughter as well, my youngest daughter. And then, you know, the eldest daughter was very much an individual, sports person. And I was, I just liked to do it on my own. I didn't want to rely on other people.
Yeah.
So I guess that was it.
I totally understand. That's how I felt about jiu-jitsu. And it's almost quite strange that, I mean, it makes sense that all the main sports that we're exposed to as youngsters are team sports. It makes sense, because you can just pile all the kids into a team and you can get them to play football or rugby or basketball or whatever it is. But there's this huge difference between being as part of a team and then your individual sports, your tennis, your athletics, your martial arts, you know, stuff like that. And I think for some people, they thrive in the sort of anonymity of a team where they're able to be part of this bigger thing. But then not only do you have to necessarily, you have to rely on other people to help you win. And then also other people can bring you down when you lose.
Well, I think, you know, you look at judo at the moment and we have a big team event. I mean, the Olympics now have just introduced the team event, which is an amazing event. They get three women, three men, three amalgamated categories.
Oh, wow.
And compete in a team event as individuals, but the team result kind of is what it's all about, you know. So they can go 3-3 in this team event, and then they draw the category out the hat who has to fight again.
Oh yeah.
And it's an amazing possibility, you know, like, so they might draw you out, so you've just had the fight of your life in the team. Yeah. Olympic Games final, and they might and you might have just won, or you might have just lost in this team event. And then they pull roll the dice.
Yeah.
And you can see the dice rolling up on a big screen, and it can be your weight category that gets drawn out again, and you have to come immediately back out and fight again.
The same person. So that's in the Olympics now?
That's in the Olympics. And it was such a... And we've had three world championships and the Olympic Games.
Really?
Yeah, with that event in. So, you know, and it's very difficult to get team events into... like, yes. So there's limited amount of Olympic medals, limited amount. So to get an event in like that was an amazing feat from the president of the International Judo Federation. But he got it in. And I can't tell you how exciting it is from a commentator's point of view when you get a situation like that. And you imagine you get your name pulled out again. You're on the way out. You've just won or you've just lost. So you got your head down and you're on the way out, and and your category comes up and you've got to turn back around and you've got to come back out. And they do it as what they call a golden score situation. So if we do our first in individual matches, if we do first 4 minutes, and there's no score on there, it goes into golden score, and then first score wins. So you can score any score, groundwork or standing or three penalties, and it's all over. And it goes into a immediate golden score situation. So you can win the gold medal for your team at the Olympic Games on the next throw the dice.
Wow.
Yeah. And and the reason I'm saying this to you is that, as much of a team man that I'm not, you know what I mean? I could see myself being part of that team situation because then it would be back down to me, I guess, you know, to win the Olympic gold medal for the team. No pressure, no pressure at all. But, and I've seen it. I saw it in the junior world. We had junior world final between Russia and Japan. And the Japanese just managed to, in the last... they had to win the last match to get a golden score situation, right? And in the last 10 seconds, the Japanese scored on the Russian, and it was 3-3. So then it went to the board. You know, they threw the dice. They see this dice rolling, and it's him again. So he's on the way out there. This Japanese has just won it. The Russian's got his head like down like that, and they had to turn around, came straight back out. The Russian got hold of him and within 10 seconds threw the Japanese and won it.
Wow.
And so within 30 seconds, this Russian had lost it and won it.
Wow.
It was amazing, you know. So, yeah, very exciting.
And is there any – it's funny that you mention that, because we have a couple of different team – it's like this interesting thing where it's a team event but the sport's still individual. And we have a few of those in jiu-jitsu now. Is there any other format – because obviously judo's been around for so much longer. Has there been any other form of team judo events through different rule sets to that?
Yeah, well, they used to do separate men and women's teams. So they do the seven weight categories of the women – All right, so they'd have a women's team match competition.
But it would be individual matches? They'd only have
individual one match? Individual matches, right? So, but seven weight categories, you'd always have a 4-3, all right? So, and what they wanted to do, because there was always more, it's all about the equality of the sport, and they want equal amounts of women as they've got the men, you know, at the Olympic Games. And so the best way they could do that was by amalgamating the two lightest weight categories and then the amalgamating the two heaviest weight categories. So that made just three men, three women. And so it's dead equal, you know, so your woman can win it for you, or the men could win it for you. And the great thing about the team thing, as far as team building, was that it created interest. So people would always say that team match was always one of the most interesting things.
Well, there's a bigger narrative story arc outside of an individual match.
Yeah.
When you're doing a team event.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, and I kind of grew up through the team event. So I came through the team event, but I never actually as an individual liked it that much. You know, I didn't like, you know, and when I didn't like it, especially didn't like it, was if somebody lost it for me. to be quite honest, you know, I mean, I'm a bit different now. No, I'm not. I'm no different.
It's in there somewhere still.
Yeah, it's still in there. Yeah, I'd still hate losing. But I guess you learn to handle it a little bit better.
Yeah. So anyway, going back to sort of your journey in, you took to judo. At what point did you, I mean, was there a moment, because obviously you went on to become, you know, the most successful British judoka that we've ever had, I believe still up until now. So you became super, super world class. Was there a moment where you realized that you had something special, or was it just this slow, continuous, gradual increase in skill until the top?
I think, like with most families, you know, the family, the parents, you know, will put their time into the kids and see the development. I don't think that any parent in the early stages really know, unless they're really involved with the sport. I don't think they really know how difficult it is. I mean, it rolls off the tongue, doesn't it? You know, he's a world beater. Yeah. He's going to do this. He's going to do that.
Everyone says that about everyone,
kid's
right?
Yeah. Fantastic. He's amazing, you know, and at the local event or the one just above the local event, they are amazing, you know, but you don't know what's out there.
Yeah.
And you don't know that there's, I think the first reality for me that there was somebody similar to the mentality that I had, and also somebody as good as was, because I went all the way through the junior ranks, and I won everything in the junior ranks, and my first international match was when I was 18. It was the Cadet European Championships in Israel. And I remember stepping out there, and I remember fighting an Italian. And I mean, we were to meet these guys later, you know, at Olympic Games and World Championships. But it's the first time I've ever been treated with like disdain, you know, and you know, like, he's gone, who's this young kid, you know, and basically I've come into this group of fighters that are equally as determined as me and talented, really talented, you know, and I realized then I wasn't alone. And I don't think that the parents can possibly realize that this is the case. And and then, of course, from cadets, you've got juniors under 20s, under, you know, then you've got seniors. And you, I mean, like on the world rankings now, I mean, you've got different events, World Cup, European Cup events, you've got Grand Slams, Grand Prix Grand Slams, and then you've got World Championships. And, you know, you've got all these different levels that you have to go through in order to get to that kind of level. To win a World Championships is really not easy. It's not an easy thing to do. And it's progressive. And I think, you know, I realized, and then I think my parents realized, that it wasn't going to be, it's not an easy thing, you know. It's not that you can just go out there and it suddenly happens. You've got to take the kind of steps, you know. As somebody said to me once, you know, you can't take the escalator, you know. You've got to take the steps, you know. You've got to take the stairs, and it's one at a time. And I think the real breakthrough for me was because I was pretty advanced power-wise, I was very much a boy, still a boy. But my mental state enabled me to kind of compete with the men quite early on. And I remember I did my first senior European Championships at 17. I lost third round in senior Europeans. And the next year, I fought, I was 18, and that 12 months made a massive difference to me. And I remember that third match I fought the Olympic champion. And it could have been anybody in front of me. You know, I mean, with the greatest of respect to Nevzorov, who was the world and Olympic champion, I just came out and I just, it could have been anybody there. You know, I just wanted to fight anybody, you know. And I took him really, really close. And really close. And so to the degree where I had to fight him twice over 2 days, wow, because I fought him in the team match as well. And he came blistering, Russia versus Great Britain. And second time he came out, like he just wanted to kill me, you know. But what happened was, is that, you know, he was so over the top trying to get me, you know, that it was going away from him. And and I realized after that, and I had another really close match with him, and so I went time with the Olympic champion twice.
Wow.
Very close. And I was only 18, you know, just, and I knew then. And L'Equipe, who was like really big sports newspaper in France, said, oh, you know, he's this boy might do it, you know. And so I kind of realized then that I had a chance.
Yeah.
At that level.
Yeah, it's that moment I think all elite guys have where you get this. I mean, a lot of people have it where it goes the other way and you have that moment where you go, I don't think this is for me. But then you have that moment and go, I just almost took out the Olympic champ. Yeah, I'm 18 years old.
And I wasn't far off. And I remember, you know, I never had any doubt in my mind. But then what did I know about that level? You know what I mean? I didn't know anything about that level. And but then people were telling me, saying, you know, this is it. So actually, with the right preparation, by the time I came another year down the road, I was totally different. And then that's when I won my first European title. And then it all kind of began at the much higher level.
So you won your first European title at 19.
I was 19, just coming into, I was 2 months off 20.
Wow.
Yeah.
Is that young for you? Like, I don't know exactly what the ages are like for that.
For men.
Sort of, it sounds very young.
It's young for men.
Yeah.
Because I wasn't fully developed.
Yeah.
From a physical perspective, I was quite skinny, you know. So, I mean, I remember we're looking at some old photographs and Nikki, my wife, would go, you're quite skinny then, you know. And I was, you know, I didn't have a, but I had a kind of a...
I mean, you haven't finished growing.
I hadn't finished growing. I was developing all the way through. So I was getting through on something else, you know, and it was that kind of determination and also the skill aspect, which was massive as far as we were concerned as a family. My dad always ensured that we trained really well with the skill side and that we learned how the fundamental principles of how to throw from very young. You know, so as a kid, I was always throwing. It was never about just winning. And I think that was with me all the way through. You know, it wasn't, and I think that's one of the problems now is that I see with a lot of the kids and a lot of parents, you know, that through their kids, and it's win at all costs. And it was never win at all costs. It was always about learning the game and learning how to do it properly.
Yeah, it's a bigger picture approach of your skills and your abilities and your level. When you only focus on winning, there's a time and place for that. But when you only focus on winning in training, you don't develop. And so you might get the short-term results, but it's by focusing instead on growing and increasing your skill to the maximum level that you're going to get the bigger results down the line.
Yeah, and it's pretty much like we're doing at the moment because we have our own skills base, stuff that we are selling online, you know, like the that people can access, you know, but it's all about learning the fundamental principles of how to throw. And but it's not just about how to throw. It's not just me teaching you a movement or a technique. You know, there's no one technique that you teach first. What you have to do is you have to have a resource that you can access that is goes before that. You know, so we realized that we needed a resource that wasn't just teaching how to, you know, your left leg goes here, your right leg goes there, or this is how you get the arm out, or this is, you know, a different way of doing jujigatami or an arm lock or whatever it is. But getting you to understand the concepts of movement first. Much more important, you know, and then actually once you understand the concepts of movement and how to stand and how to move in the right way, then you can start to add the techniques to it, you know. And I think that when I look back now, that that was one of my biggest advantages is that I learned how to throw from an early age and then it really served me well later on. Because, simple reason is that then I started to add things on, you know, so like I had a particular technique and then I'd look at different ways in, you know, and then as I went through my kind of career, people started to video me and research the way I did it. And then I'd just try and take it a step further and then I'd just try to find another way, you know, try and adapt.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great insight into, you know, what takes someone to the top of their craft. And I mean, it sounds like I've kind of picked up that the two big things that you had at that early age that gave you that early success was the focus on skills, primarily the throw-in, but more importantly, the fundamental movements. And then also something you've alluded to a couple of times, which is the mindset and your mental game. That's something that is probably of more interest to me than any of the physical stuff or technical stuff, because you can have someone who is of equal skill who is unable to make it to the absolute highest elite Olympic level. So I want to dive in, if we can, a little bit into your mindset, sort of how your thoughts and your mindset works in terms of training, in terms of competition, and how you got to that stage.
I think that, you know, when you look at some of the documentaries now that they've got Netflix and stuff, you know, and you look at Michael Jordan and you look at his mindset, you know, and he's not always the most popular character. He is and he isn't. You know, you love him or you hate him.
Yeah.
But I don't think I've ever seen anybody that so driven. And that's coming from somebody who's driven.
Yeah. He's the perfect example of the most, like, the possibly the greatest sporting mindset of all time.
Yeah. Well, and you know, what impressed me with that is that, you know, he was getting pissed off with people that were not giving their all to, you know, team match is what we're talking about here. You know, he's in a team competition, but he's an individual, you know, in his that he just wants to win everything. He doesn't want to lose. And if he's got, if he's surrounded by people that are not going to contribute to that, you know what I mean? He doesn't like that. We talked about it earlier. We were talking about when I first started training with Ray Stevens he asked me whether he could come in to train with me full time. And I said, well, I need somebody who's going to be there all the time, you know. And not only was he there all the time, but, you know, he was pushing me every single bit of the way. In the end, you know, I surrounded myself only with people that could do it and people that were going to help me achieve what I wanted to achieve. And I think that's, you know, when it comes to coaches and things like that, you know, and I mean, I've had my daughters going to, you know, like I, my son, first of all, rugby club, you know, and I can recognize whether a coach is on the ball and whether they're going in the right direction or, and, you know, so once or twice had to change direction with, the, you know, how they're going to develop and things like that. And I think that I did that as far as coaching is concerned and as far as, you know, my dad laid the foundation as far as, you know, the skills aspect is concerned. But certainly, I mean, give me 10 of me, you know, and I mean this, you know, in a way that's not conceited, in as that, you know, I just needed to get my head wrapped around, you know, I mean, I had a direction. I still do it now. And I, you know, once I set my mind on something, I'm going towards that goal, and yeah. I just get blinkered, you know, and I want to finish it, you know, and I'm still like that now in my, you know, mid 60s. And I'm like, you know, and Nick will say, you know, it's kind of a, it's a curse and it's a blessing all in one, you know, and I can't help myself, you know, I just want to finish, just let me finish this and then I'll concentrate on the other things. Mm. And I think I was like that as a competitor. I wanted to get the training done. I always prepared well, always. I never went in half bait. I always went in fully prepared. And, you know, if I couldn't, saying that, you know, the odd time from an injury, yep. It wasn't quite 100%, and I'd know it, you know.
Done everything you could do.
Everything I could do to get prepared within that time limit. But when I look back, I wouldn't do it again now.
Yeah.
I'd do it a little bit differently. But, I mean, my preparation was always good. I'm very hot on the preparation. And, you know, I thank goodness that I had that mindset, you know. And like I say, I recognize it through people like Michael Jordan and, you know, some of these. We're just watching the golf one at the moment. And some of these youngsters, you know, you can see it on there. So when the youngsters coming through, you know, into the PGA, you know, tour are amazing. You know, they absolutely, it's about winning. Nothing, you know, they know they're going to win.
Yeah.
And then you've got interviews with some of the ones that know they're not going to win.
Mm.
And they don't.
Yeah, that's, I mean, I think you're spot on. I don't think anyone gets to the highest level of anything without having this dogged determination and drive towards success. I guess the big question is, do you think that that is something that can be developed, or is it simply something that you are or aren't born with?
I think it can be developed to a degree, but I think that some people are just born with that absolute drive, determination. And you know, they, yes, I mean it, you know, most I think of the ones that have been World Olympic champion have had a period of their lives when they've not been the most popular person, been a bit of an ass, you know. And I think that's not an excuse. And it's not, you know, I just think that it's just something that you have to be a little bit selfish in order to, you know, to get that drive. And, you know, the time, I've just written a chapter on my book, Game of Thrones, right? And I've just done an extra
fantastic name, I just had to say.
Game of Thrones. So we're doing a relaunch, and so I had to do an extra chapter. So I wrote about three Olympic preparations and how my mentality changed and how it was different for the three. You know, one as an 18-year-old, one as somebody that was approaching a time when I was going to get married, and then third one when I had a 5-year-old son.
Wow.
Three different preparations and three different mindsets.
So let's get into that, because, you know, we're talking about your journey. And did you just say that you had your first Olympics when you were 18?
Wow. I think yes, my first Olympics. Well, and I was first reserved for the 76 Olympics as well, so I did the preparation up to those, and then my three Olympics were 80, 84 and 88.
So how old were you when you were for the 76?
So 16 coming up for the 76 games, I think. So I'm 64 now. So my mind's going. Excuse me.
I would be nearer 20
coming up for the 80 Olympics.
So you were 16
when you were
on the reserves for the first Olympics.
I got, so at 16 years of age, I fought the Senior British Open, which was the trials for the Olympic Games.
Yeah.
So the guy that went, called Vass Morrison, and he was built, like, he was stacked and really good. Vass was so good. And so I got to the final of the British Open and had him in the final. Right?
Wow.
So, and took him really, really close. I mean, so I lost on one very minor score. And so he grabs me, he said, I'm glad it's now I fought you, you know.
Yeah.
And then quite rightly, he went to the Olympics, you know, and I was going, oh, you know, I should have gone, but I shouldn't have, you know. No. I mean, it was absolutely, it's his time. And then he fought for third. He nearly got bronze at the Olympics, you know. So it was, yeah. So, yeah, I was knocking on the door then. I was as a 16-year-old. Yeah.
Which is completely bonkers.
Completely bonkers if you'd have seen my physical state and him.
Wow.
If we'd have stood next to each other, honestly, if I turned sideways and stuck my tongue out, I'd look like a zip. I mean, I was that thin. I was, you know, and he was like, got these muscles on muscles.
So at that, how more advanced? Because when I think about jiu-jitsu competition scene and I think about how it was just 10 years ago compared to how it is now, it's so much deeper in talent. It's so much wider in talent. It's so much more competitive. But jiu-jitsu is just a much newer sport in general. Is that similar to judo? Because judo is a much, much older sport. So back when you were competing then, is there a huge difference in how competitive a British championship is today than it was when you, you know, came second place when you were 16?
I think it's a lot harder. I think it was a lot harder then because we had a lot of big pool and of talent.
Were there more people?
I think they're struggling. But I think that what you've got in jiu-jitsu at the moment is that you're on such a...
Trajectory.
Mm. And I think that the level, when you think about, I mean, I would have loved to have had the situation where because I would have definitely, absolutely doubled up on some of my training.
Yeah.
I mean, it would have been perfect for me. It would have been so perfect.
And, I mean, you did pretty good without it.
Yeah,
so.
But, you know, I give you an example. In 1978, all right, so I was definitely 70-30 standing groundwork, right? And in 1978, I fought a Frenchman called Gilbert in the final of the British Open, right? So I came. So what I did was I decided to fight the weight up to what I normally fight. So I thought, you know, so I thought I'd just fight the weight up, get a bit more competition. And so I was winning against Gilbert and everything good. And then he caught me on the ground and strangled me. And I was mortified. Mm. I mean, I'm mortified. I can't tell you how mortified I was. And that was my biggest lesson. And I decided after that, I said, nobody's ever going to beat me in their wise, you know, judo wise. You know, I'm sure in jiu-jitsu terms, it would have happened. But that would have helped me tremendously. But I did go into my next competitions there. I just decided that I'm going to bring my newaza up, my groundwork up, and make it 50-50. That was my main aim, was to make it 50% standing, 50% ground, and to make it as equal as I possibly could and make my transition better, you know. And anyway, so that was my biggest lesson and the best thing that could have happened to me.
Yeah, I mean, there's two directions I want to go off of that, talking more about the Niwaza, but maybe we'll save that a little bit till later, because I still want to carry on about this, you know. You're saying that there was probably more the competition was harder back then when you know when you were 16. So because my thought when you said that is there anyone, or has there been anyone else since that time that has been that young, competing at that level, beating seniors? Has there been someone sort of at the prodigy level that you were back then? Is there anyone else like that?
Internationally, yes.
But not in the UK?
No, I'm talking UK as far as, you know, the depth that we had. We had a really massive depth of great judoka, Olympic world medalists. And, you know, the women's side, always very, very strong, and they're still strong now. The men struggling to come through with the level at the moment. I think it will happen, but only to get the right team managers in there and the right, you know. But I think it will happen, absolutely. Internationally, there was a guy called Ilias Iliadis, and he was 17, and he was fighting the men and won the Olympics 17 years of age.
Yeah. Was he that young? Because I remember when he won, yeah.
Yeah, 17 years of age, you know, and everybody went, wow.
He won the Olympics at 17.
And, you know, from a mental perspective, didn't believe that he would enter open tournaments, you know, just thought he could fight anybody, you know. And he really, honestly, in his, and I know him personally now, because I mean, so I'm his like training partner. If we go and we get caught in a gym or hotel gym, you know, so he's over and he forgets that I'm 64 years of age, right? This maniac grabs me, and he just is that, you know, he has this amazing mentality, you know, that you recognize straight away. And if you're talking to him, you know, and you just, there's nothing in his mind that no doubts.
And is there a lot to be said to kind of just throwing caution to the wind and just attacking everything like nobody can stop you?
Yeah. I mean, you know, if you don't believe it, and then it's the surprise when something does go wrong, you know, and that's what, you know.
Well, can that be a negative?
It can be. It depends on how you handle it, you know. And I always, so I always look, I mean, you know, take Renair. Renair is the heavyweight champion of the world, you know. He was the heavyweight champion of the world for over a decade.
Wow.
Three-time Olympic champ, two-time Olympic champion individual. And this man is going for the next Olympics in France, right? And he's really over his best. But still, they can't beat him, right? So in his mind, he is going to win the Olympic gold medal. Without a doubt, it's in his mind, you know. And
do you actually think he will?
I think he could, because it's in France. And, you know, the batch of heavyweights, there's nobody absolutely exceptional. That, you know, there's a few. If he pulls maybe two or three of the more difficult ones back to back, it could go wrong. Of course it could go wrong. And you know, and I just, yeah, in his mind he doesn't think it's going to go wrong. And you know, and I think that kind of mentality is something that we recognize in few, but you, when you see it, you go, right, you know, that's a unique breed.
They've either got it or they don't.
No, they have. And you know, some try and change it. I watched on the golf yesterday, and there was a guy that was on the PGA tour, and he did well, you know. And this is, you know, he's somebody that's well known for doing really, really well, you know, so making enough money because he's coming fifth and sixth, you know. But and then when interviewed, you know, I've got the ability to do it. You know, that's, you know, it's, there's no maybe in it. You know, I had no doubt. I said when I was 17, 18 years of age that I was going to become world champion. To be honest, I didn't know how difficult that was going to be. Right. But in my mind, it was there, you know, and there's no, I just said, I'm going to do it. I am going to do it. And I just had no doubt. When I won the world title on that day, it was one of those where I just, you know, you could have thrown anything at me and it would have, you know. And,
just on form.
Yeah, on good form. Everything aligned, you know, everything was working well. Good build up to the event, you know, and good preparation. For me, the massive one was that if I got the preparation right, so I'd always aim for consistency of performance with my preparation. So they all looked pretty much the same, even when I was feeling a bit off, you know, and I still do that now. I'd still go in the gym. And even at my age, you know, I've got a minimum and a maximum, you know, so a minimum performance here. And I, you know, on a good day, I can do this. But I will always try and be consistent.
Yeah. And, you know, talking about as a competitor myself, I know that you can have days where just everything feels good. And you can have days where everything feels bad. Is that something that you've experienced? And if so, have you found any justification or reasoning as to why that can happen?
Preparation and also doubt. So, you know, sometimes you know what it's like as a competitor, like the odd time something's in your mind there, it's just an element of doubt, you know. And once you've put, it's like skiing down a hill. And somebody says to you, don't hit the tree.
So you're thinking.
It's all you're thinking, all right? So you and what happens, right? You guarantee you'll aim for that tree, you'll come into sight, you know? And I think that once, you know, that's why we have the psychologists, and we know that. And, you know, it's just making sure that you have enough consistency and preparation, I think, that to alleviate those elements of doubt. And I think that, you know, we know that people have money problems, or, you know, it's girlfriend chop problems or boyfriend problems or whatever it is, you know, and or there might be problems at home, or we might have lost a loved one, or there might be so many different things that that are going to contribute to that element of doubt. But I think once that element of doubt's in there, you know, even with that element of doubt, I try to always be consistently there and roundabout with, you know. So I mean, I think there was only one event in 12 years that I didn't get a medal at, and that was you know, and so that consistency of performance was what I aim for.
I mean, that is
at European world level I'm talking about.
I don't know enough about the scope of judo competition, but that sounds so insane that over 12 years you've not medaled in only one tournament.
Yeah, it was one European Championships, and it was the same year I won the world title. And I
had a lot of pressure.
Well, what happened was the semi-final of that European Championships, I was a score up and then got a penalised for something that, you know, so normally I never play the rules, you know. So like if there's like you've got an edge of the area, and I don't play that. I don't play games, right? So I didn't like taking chances with anything, right? And this particular occasion, he was really bad on the edge, and I took him near the edge, and it backfired on me, you know, and I got penalized and not him. So to this day, I still think he should have been penalised, right? Without a shadow of a doubt.
That's but the competitor coming out.
Yeah. And I lost the match on it. And and then I lost for third place against a Russian. And that was really controversial as well. Anyway, I ended up no medal in it. Devastated, right? Mm. And that was the only major event that I didn't get a medal in.
I mean, it's kind of unfathomable to think of that level of consistency in any sport where you're at the top level for so long and meddling every single time.
Always there and about. And, you know, I think that, yeah, that for me was a great success, you know, because then it
consistency.
Meant that the consistency was a big thing about it. And I think also being able to adjust to certain things that were happening through my career. So like, for example, when I went 50-50, you know, with the groundwork and the standing, yeah, you know, and I started to look for different things to win on the ground, you know, and then the arm lock really developed, you know. So like from the transition down, I was really fast at catching it. I was really good at getting into the position I wanted. So, but then, as with anything, people started to read it, right? Mm. And then they'd start to cover up, and then I'd switch, and then I'd go, like, I'd use something else to open it up for certain things. And just adding things to the repertoire, really, and not just being, you know, one-dimensional.
But evolving.
Evolving, yeah, from it, you know. And I think that is the magical thing about the jiu-jitsu. You know, and one of the reasons that the judo, the jiu-jitsu level in groundwork is just, you know, I mean, yeah, you know, it's just, and that's why I don't know where my net was and my groundwork would have been with that as well, you know.
So that's a massive thing that I wanted to talk to you about, which is your niwaza, your groundwork, your floor grappling, because it's so well known that was one of your strengths. Obviously, you've already sort of said that there's a reason for that. You got strangled, devastated. You started to go 50-50 on the stand up and the grappling. To start this, let's just look at what it's like now, because the rules has changed to make the niwaza pretty much useless in modern day judo. Is that safe to say?
Not now, because we've pushed really hard.
Well, you've got it back in now?
We've got it back in, okay. Right? Okay, so as long as it's developing, there's chance of it finishing with a nippon, as long as it's got a different progression, then they'll allow it to carry on. So we pushed really, really hard. I'm on the referee commission now for IJF, and we pushed really hard for, you know, because, I mean, it was going literally 80% standing. Because, I mean, what happened was the time that you got down there was, you know, was hardly any time whatsoever. Coaches wouldn't train it. Why should I?
Yeah.
You know, and so it was predominantly more standing. And we said, well, that's crazy, because, you know, that's why when we were talking just before we came on air there, I said that the really good groundwork people judo-wise are the ones that transition. Really smooth transition, because then the smooth transition from standing, and remember that, you know, the control that you need to throw somebody with the hands, and this is a massive advantage of being a good thrower, is that the control you have with the hands means that you can immediately follow through into ground. You don't let go and then go.
Yeah.
You keep control and then control the situation. And so we managed to push it so that we've got loads of more time. You know, so we had out of a 4 minute fight, we had a 1 minute 40 niwaza groundwork exchange. All right, so half of that whole match was just progression and almost and nearly change of direction, but, you know, the referee let it carry on. If it goes from inside outside and it's continuous like that, the referee lets it carry on, even though it's outside the area, as long as it doesn't go on to the next area.
Yep.
Right, and he'll just let it go, and then if it until it catches, you know. So it's changed, which is amazing, and we pushed really hard to get that.
Because, I mean, we were talking about this earlier before we came on air about how the changing of a rule in a sport, especially like our sports, it needs to be done with so much consideration. Because what I think sometimes people don't understand is that the entire sport moves from top down. If you change the rules in, for example, in jiu-jitsu, you change the rules in IBJJF, or suddenly ADCC rule set becomes popular, the style of the martial art throughout every gym in the world changes. And we've seen that over the last couple of years with Brazilian jiu-jitsu, as the more no-gi events have become popular that allow heel hooks, and now the IBJJF at black belt adult, and I think maybe brown belt adult, but I'm not 100% sure, are allowing heel hooks and knee reaps. The entire sport changes. I imagine that there's an even bigger effect with when they've made big changes to the rule set in judo. Suddenly, over a couple of years, the entire style looks different.
Yeah, totally. I mean, you know, if you have a look at back to the 19, people always, so we had a big change of the rules where you couldn't take the legs. So it stood it up. So what happened was, it was all bent over like this, you know, because you're defending your legs, somebody diving at your legs. And so bad at one stage that it's freestyle wrestling.
Yeah.
The jacket's on, right?
Yeah.
So it's freestyle. And so the Olympic committee actually came to IJF, to International Judo, and said, well, this is wrestling with jackets on. So you need to do something to give it its identity.
Yeah.
You look back at 1960s, when judo was first introduced at world level, 58, 59, 60, up to 64 Olympic Games, and it's very upright. There weren't a lot of leg grabs. You know, the Russians brought in the leg grabbing. And
because they had this space in wrestling.
Yeah, because it was a wrestling background, you know. So they're the ones that brought it in, you know, take the legs. And so if you look at it from this perspective, are they able to stand up and do an uchimata, which is a throw off one leg with the balance going in the right direction, controlling with the hands, you know? No, because they've never learnt that. Much easier to grab the legs on a double or a single leg, you know? Yeah. And I mean, you've got to believe, I mean, I've commentated at the Olympics and Commonwealth Games for judo, freestyle and Greco.
Oh, wow.
All right, for all of them. And I the appreciation I've got for the two wrestling styles, you know, for the Greco and for the freestyle is fantastic, you know, but I'm there to watch wrestling. I'm not there to watch a mixture of the two, you know. So we had to keep an identity. So actually what happened was a lot of the wrestlers pretty fed up about it, you know, pretty cut up about it.
Left.
Because they'd have to come in, you see. So what we say to the wrestlers is there's no problem coming in and doing both the sports, but you have to learn how to throw from a judo perspective first, right? And then it's a bit like me going into wrestling because I did the British Wrestling Championships one time and was catching people with foot sweeps, right? And they're going, well, that's not wrestling. And they're right. It wasn't, right? But they couldn't stand on their feet, right? And,
yeah.
And so therefore they were pretty peed off with me. And so actually learning to stand up and defend from an upright position, it stood it up like that immediately. So I haven't got to worry about you just diving for my legs so I can defend. But also it means that I've got to learn to throw you from a standing perspective, whether it's to the back or to the front or whatever. And I've got to learn the mechanics of throwing. So actually, if you look at the mechanics of throwing a body with power, you need to use the hands, the feet, the body, everything together.
Mm.
All right. It's not just about diving with the legs and doing a rugby tackle. You know, that's not what it's about. It's a lot more complex than that. So you've got to learn the complexities of throwing.
So you actually see the removal of the leg grabs in judo to be a positive thing because it keeps the style of judo, it keeps the traditional characteristics of judo alive and forces people to continue to train these judo techniques.
Yeah, and also teaches them to come into judo, to learn judo. And then, you know, if they want to do both. So we do get, like in the United States, there are a lot of wrestling judoka.
Yeah.
All right. Most of them have more predominantly judo and then, you know, wrestling. Or some of them it's 50-50, but some of them can do both really, really well. Mm. So we've got a lot of countries now at the moment that like the Mongolians, the Georgians and the Russians and, you know, they come in and there's a lot of the Eastern Bloc countries have a lot of, you can tell that they have a wrestling backgrounds. But they're learning to control it through the hands as well. So some of the techniques and some of the suplexes and some of the, you know, are amazing. So, I mean, it's developing judo in a fantastic way because they're learning judo first and then using their wrestling skills as well. And that makes it fantastic. But what I don't want to see is, you know, wrestlers coming in, don't know anything about judo. And of course, the obvious way to get somebody down is single leg, double leg, or wait, you know, for a suplex, you know, if it happens with Greco, for example. But it is very interesting to have a look at it. It did upset a few people. Most of the people that are really upset, the ones that, you know, if you... the ones that can't make the crossover into judo and wrestling from wrestling into judo are the ones that don't know the complexities of the judo throws.
Yeah, that makes sense. I guess the big difference with that I've always seen that from outside, you know, outside of judo, I've always seen that as a bad thing. But the way that you explain it, it makes so much more sense. And I can see why that would be a positive thing to keep judo.
Yeah,
I guess the difference with jiu-jitsu is it's such a young sport, and really Brazilian jiu-jitsu and grappling is a bastardization of the niwaza of judo. Like, there's no doubt about it. We are fully aware of our origins, and it's a very recent sport. And because of that, there is no traditional historical look or characteristics to it. Sort of the whole idea of jiu-jitsu is that it is a always evolving sport. Jiu-jitsu today looks very different to jiu-jitsu just 5 years ago, which looks different to 5 years before that and 5 years before that. So we sort of move in a direction of less rules to just let jiu-jitsu be more organically whatever it is going to be, and no one cares because there's no historical style. Whereas things like judo, where you want to keep this historical style more alive, you've got to use the rule set to steer that in the right direction.
Yeah, and I think that if you have a look at the way that jiu-jitsu is developing, I mean, you know, we were talking about rules dictate development,
yep.
You know, and I think that, I mean, they will have to probably have a look at some of the matches where you just get somebody who throws guard and they're, you know, walking crab-like around, and, you know, and it's, and you kind of look at it and...
I mean, that is, if jiu-jitsu has a style, that is the style.
Right.
That is the characteristic.
If you just changed it from that you couldn't throw, you know, guard immediately, but had to throw into the situation.
Yeah.
I think you'd find that the level of standing would go up in jiu-jitsu, you know, because they'd bring that kind of balance up a little bit because they'd have to, you know. But I think a lot of people don't like, you know, because I've talked to a lot of jiu-jitsu people, don't like the standing work because of the injury aspect. Mm-hmm. But I think the injury aspect only comes because they're not prepared.
Yeah.
All right. And I think, you know, it's something that you do come, and you do have a preference. I mean, I understand it. I mean, I love my groundworks. Mm. You know, I still love it. I absolutely, you know, I love it because I'm not bad at it, you know, and I've got quite a good balance at it, you know, but I would have liked to have definitely, when I look at it now at the level of the jiu-jitsu, I would have just benefited tremendously from it. But on the other side of that, I've seen people that have gone into jiu-jitsu, judo guys now, all right, that, and it works against them, you know, and it works against them because it's a totally different way in. It's a different time scale. It's not just about submitting somebody. It's about, you know, we have hold downs as well. And also, you got to get in there quicker and make it progressive. And if you don't, you stand up. You know, they stand you up. So it kind of makes it a little bit different. So you have to kind of take the good things out of the jiu-jitsu, the methodical teaching and the methodical progression that has come from it, and then kind of put a speed element in. You know, and
a bit of urgency.
A bit of an urgency, yeah.
Yeah. And I have to ask, just because you mentioned it, you said you were talking about Mongolian judo and Mongolian wrestling, and it's just a massive interest that I have in the Mongolian traditional, is it bokke or their traditional style of wrestling. And I saw you got a statue of a Mongolian wrestler out there as I walked in. First thing I saw as I walked in your house. So I had to ask, have you been to Mongolia firstly?
Loads of times.
And have you really?
Dear friends of mine there, you know, and I was in the National Dojo training there, and the youngsters just so keen to get on with you, and they have this a very special style of, I mean, now they're the most successful Olympic sport is judo in Mongolia. All right.
Because this wrestling is one of their national sports.
One of their national sports, and they've all come from the wrestling background, you know, but then the first Olympic champion that they ever had in the country, all sports, was judo. And you know, the development of judo, 3.2 million people in Mongolia, right? 3.2 million, tiny little country, right?
Oh, huge country, but
you
tiny population.
You want them coming over the top, I tell you, at you. You know, they are very special people.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, like from a heart, you know, they'd do anything for you. They, you know, the president of Mongolia was a judo man. You know, he was he was world sambo champion. And
they don't have elections, right? It's just a wrestling competition.
Unbelievable. You know,
that's a joke, by the way, if anyone listened to that.
It was a joke. First time I arrived in Mongolia, right? So I've been there many times. And I tell you, this is another interesting point. I did the first international broadcast, any sport, any international broadcast sports wise from Mongolia.
Really?
I did it, yeah. And it happened about 9-10 years ago. And so they were setting it up, and we weren't quite lined up with the satellite. So there was a problem getting it lined up. And we were going to go on air. I think we were on air at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and it was going to go live. First international broadcast.
Wow.
I'm waiting to do it, right? And they just managed to line it up, and it went ding like that, lined it up, and it was all on, and then did the international broadcast for judo. It was a judo broadcast. So I was very proud about that, you know. And so I have a lot of really good friends in Mongolia, and it's what an interesting place. 1.2 million people in Ulaanbaatar, all right? That's half the population, and the rest are nomadic.
Yeah,
they're out there in the countryside, you know, with their horses and you know, things. But what a hard life they lead. I mean, that goes minus. I mean, I spoke to a mate of mine, a friend of mine, dear friend. I work with him all the time, right? And I spoke to him, and he was in Mongolia just a couple of weeks ago, and it was minus 35 there at that time, right? But then it goes plus 30 as well.
Yeah, Mongolia is I've never been. It's the number one place in the world that I want to go to.
Absolutely.
I want to go there soon. I want to go there, and I want to like train in their traditional wrestling style, get beaten up by these huge Mongolian giants. I want to ride horses across the Mongolian steppes. But yeah, to talking about the temperature, Ulaanbaatar is officially the coldest capital city in the world. It gets to minus 50, I think, sometimes, which is completely
bonkers.
It's
amazing. You know, the first time I arrived in Mongolia, they said, oh, the festival's on, you know.
So the Namdam.
So the festival was on, and they said, you've just arrived for the finals of the wrestling competition are happening in the big stadium at the moment. And so what happens is, with the wrestling competition, right, the whole country takes part.
Yeah.
So the whole country takes part. So the postman can be fighting like a grand, you know, like, and so it comes all the way down to the last few.
Yeah.
And then it's in the big stadium. I said, don't take me to the hotel. Take me to the stadium. So we went to the stadium there, and then there, you know, and then it's the real deal then. Then you've got all the proper wrestlers doing it. So I caught the finals of the wrestling. So then they took me from there into the countryside, where they've got the horse race was just about to start. So the horse race, they send all these, like, so they 50% of the money goes to the trainer of the horses, or the owner, and then 50% goes to the winner rider, who are children, they're kids, right? And they send these horses off, and then 3/4 of the horses come back without kids on them. All right. So that somehow the kids, and so they have to go, they send trucks out to find these kids and rescue these kids and bring them back in. It's amazing. And then archery.
So that's the three, for those who don't know about the Mongolian, like, national sports festival, the Namdam, it's the three manly sports, they say, which is wrestling, horseback riding, and archery. Those are the three sports that they kind of revere,
So we went to see the archery, right? So they've got them set up, they've got the targets there, and then they've got a guy in between the targets. So I said, what's the guy doing? He said, oh, the guy's directing the bloke, you know, with the thing. You wouldn't want him to be wrong.
Yeah.
You know, and I said, you're kidding, like that, you know, and these big bows. And it was just the most amazing thing. It is the most amazing country I've ever been to.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, God. I mean, I wanted to go there beforehand, but I want to go there even more now. That just sounds incredible.
Brilliant.
Just because you mentioned it, we had to talk a bit about Mongolia. I'm so glad we did. But I just want to go back to one thing that you were talking about beforehand, because, you know, we're talking about your Niwaza, going back to the Niwaza stuff, you know, you've mentioned it a couple of times that you were doing 50-50 Niwaza and Tachiwaza?
Yes.
The stand-up?
Standing, yeah.
And do you believe that should be the ratio of which judo exists in?
Yeah. Mm. I think that the rules should aim for that. That's where we should aim. That's our big advantage. You know, that's what makes us unique. That's what makes us different to jiu-jitsu, right? So the jiu-jitsu, I mean, and what we don't want to be is totally opposite to jiu-jitsu. So I don't want people.
Because that's what it feels like.
Yeah. And I don't want people to have the idea that jiu-jitsu is ground and judo is standing, right?
Yeah.
Because it's not true, because we have got some pretty, you know, and I know there's, you know, some specialist jiu-jitsu guys out there were going, you know, well, you know, it's some of the techniques are, we've done that, and we've been there, and we do that
it's
all the time.
It's moved on, yeah.
But actually, some of the ways that they're performed and the way that they're developed, they're a little bit different, you know. And so I do surprise a few of the jiu-jitsu guys when, you know, we do the juji, which I'm pretty well known for, right? But actually, I do it a little bit differently because I need to immediately catch the movement. I need to catch the arm pretty quick, and then I need to start applying pressure almost immediately. And you know what it's like. There are 1,000 ways of escaping if you haven't got it, you know, pinned in there, and it's not, you know, whereas in jiu-jitsu, you can kind of reel it in and make sure that you got everything tight.
Yeah.
Got a limited amount of time to pull it in and make sure that it's tight. So there are different ways of doing it, you know. So there's always different methods of making these techniques work. And it's good sometimes to see a different version.
Yeah, and you've just touched on it, but I've got to dig deeper because, like you said, being very modest, that you're well known for your jujikatami,
the armbar,
as we would call it. But from so many people I've spoken to, consider you to have arguably the best armbar in the world, which is the first time I heard that as a jujitsu guy who has this, you know, originally had this idea in his head that jiu-jitsu is the ground stuff and judo is the stand-up stuff, to hear that the one of the most fundamental techniques on the ground has been perfected by, or you know, this incredible exponent of it is actually a judoka. So I want you to talk to me a little bit more about the armbar, why you fell in love with the armbar, and what makes, you know, how you developed the armbar. Just a little bit about that.
I think one of the reasons was that, like, one of the first things I got taught as a youngster was how to strangle. And you know, like, so for a long time, you know, when we were as kids coming through, we were only able to hold down. So as kids, we were only able to secure a hold down. 30 seconds it was then that you held it down for. So you learned how to proportion your weight good. And then all of a sudden, into starting to come into senior judo, and realize that you could finish it a lot quicker just by getting a submission. And never even thought of the arms, but so it was always the neck. And I remember this one British Open, first time I could do it, you know, and I took ages just trying, you know, digging in, and I was trying to find a way in. I didn't have any smooth way in because I hadn't had any practice with that. But I found a way in, managed to do, you know, just a Dakajimi type technique, and just got the submission. Thought, oh, you know, that was was good first time. But then I realized that as I was starting to attack, you know, to go in, that they were leaving their arms out, you know, and their arms were kind of not tight. So just started to go onto the arms, you know. And actually then somebody said to me that you should always remember what for the shimiwaza, for the strangle, for example, it was directing, like, so to make my catch better. And by the catch, I mean that if you want to strangle somebody, you need to catch the neck, right? Okay, and going across the face, they'll stand you up, right? So I had to go for the neck, right? So somebody said to me, you need to dig in and have in your head what you're going for, right? So I thought, well, I've got to be more directed and quicker with the transition, quicker with the catch. And then it same happened with the arm lock. And I thought, right, you know, there's a lot of opportunities here for the arm. And so when I used to go in for the arm, people, like, you'd catch it while it was already out.
Yeah.
So you'd already have the arm. Then as I started to get, you know, a little bit better at it, people used to resist. So they'd pull it in, you know, or they'd either slip it or they, you know, so I when I started to train it, then people were starting to get off it. And I thought, I've got to get better at catching it and controlling it, you know, so it's got to be tight and much, much tighter, you know. So then I started to really work on the elbow and then pressure on the head at the same time, so my catch was much better, and then I'd stop them slipping, you know, off it. And I learned a lot about, you know, the catch situation when I had my own group of kind of full-time students. And I worked it a lot with them, you know, and so many different things started to come from that. And we had one of the lads, one of the, you know, he's in charge of the team now, of the GB team. But he was really difficult to catch with it. He had really good balance in it. He could slip it, and you had to be absolutely 100% kind of latched into the arm, you know. So, yeah, so I think somebody gave me the directive. They said, you got to have a directive, and you've got to think about what you want, and you've got to go for it. And the more I've noticed over the years is that the good Niwaza people, groundwork people from a judo perspective, are the ones that really have focus.
Yeah.
They really focus and go for it. They know exactly what they want, and 90% of the time they'll catch it.
Mm.
And they'll find different ways in. You know, it's not, there's, you know, one door closes, another one opens.
Mm. Yeah, it's just so interesting to hear, you know, something that I know so well, and so many people who do jiu-jitsu will know so well, but from a completely different perspective, but, you know, really someone who's studied and knows it very, very well.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's still learning from it. And, you know, I mean, I look at, I'm always looking at some of the stuff that comes out with the jiu-jitsu stuff, and, you know, I love, you know, and I mean, I'm a really big stealer of ideas,
yeah.
You know, so I'll see something, I'll go, oh wow, and I'll, you know, try and use it next time, try and incorporate it, and you know, but we're all stealers of ideas, you know.
There's not
one thing, is there, that we do really that we can say is absolutely original, you know. Yeah. People talk about triangle, you know, and triangle, whether you're doing it with the hips curl or, you know, it doesn't matter how you do it, a triangle's a triangle, right? Mm. But there's a lot of different ways in, and there's a lot of different ways of securing it, making it tighter.
Mm.
And sometimes different ways of controlling the head and the arm, and then different ways to catch it, you know, so it's always evolving. And and I'm learning all the time.
And, you know, continuing on a similar sort of thought, talking about jiu-jitsu, I want to know when the first time you heard the words Gracie Jiu-Jitsu or Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu or anything like that.
I think the first time that I was really aware of jiu-jitsu and the level was, you know, when the UFC started.
Okay.
And it was just going on with some of the, you know, these, I mean, the emphasis wasn't so much on striking then, was it? But it was, you know, certainly was getting close. He got close, you know, and he'd just taken him out. And I think that for me was UFC at its best, you know, because it just
back in the day, when it was style versus style. So did you watch UFC 1 in 93? Did you watch that live, when it happened?
I didn't watch it live.
But like around the same time it happened.
I was at a training camp. Yeah, I was at a training camp, and I remember we were watching. Funnily enough, I was watching with he was the national coach of the boxing team.
Okay.
Just happened to be sat next to him, right? We were at a training camp. It was all the fighting sports. We're at the training camp, special training camp in Tallahassee, and that's
amazing, because it's like this huge event where, for the first time ever, we're answering the question of which martial art would win if they all fought each other.
That was exactly it.
And you're together with a bunch of other martial arts.
And I was with the boxing coach, right? So, but he was watching it, and he went, "That's not right. This is not right. Marcus of Queensbury and all that, you know."
Yep.
But he was watching it. He was like, but I was looking at it and I was going, I love this. You know what I mean? I love the concept. I think that when it became too much for me is when, you know, we watched McGregor the other day, and, you know, when he, like, the face, and, you know, and when they're just pommeling them on the ground and stuff like that, it's kind of lost its way for me. But,
sure.
You know, but the early stages, I just loved the concept of it, you know, and I just thought that was magical. And I think that, which Gracie was it?
It was Royce Gracie.
Royce. Yeah. Royce and his brother and cousins came to one of my seminars when I did a seminar in Los Angeles. and they were there, and there was a massive rumpus, you know, the Graces are there.
When was that?
That was in the really early days. So he was
pre-UFC or
no,
just after?
Just after. So wow. I think he was taking, you know, he was kind of set getting certain people for money fights and things like that. And
the challenge matches?
I think that was what on their minds. But
they wanted to challenge you for a...
I think they were kind of half kind of feeling it out, you know, for
wow.
him.
Imagine
and,
that.
Yeah. And I think they were half feeling it out, and but it never came. So I'm kind of glad, because I mean, I was, you know, I couldn't see me. I think it was a little bit too close to his.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And he watched me standing and ground. It was a little bit too close. It wasn't like he could just dive on it and then dominate and then get a submission. You know what I mean? It would have been a bit more difficult. But I think that was a really interesting thing for me, because I think that he absolutely kick-started it and took it to another level. And, you know, look at what they've done now since.
But you know, when you're talking about that, sorry, I'm still reeling from the idea of you going against Royce Gracie in some sort of, you know, grappling or MMA or whatever, because of course one of the most famous, you know, as we know our jiu-jitsu history, you know, it came from Maeda, who was a judoka and taught the Gracies, and they developed it more of a, you know, primarily the grappling style on the ground, basically just, you know, it should be called I should be doing Brazilian judo. That is the reality of what it is. But of course, one of the really famous matches was Elio Gracie versus Kimura. Very, very early on.
Yeah.
A judoka who won that match with the Kimura, you know, getting the name Kimura that we use in jiu-jitsu now. So that's almost like would be the next generation's version of the Elio Kimura match.
Yeah.
So you could, I mean, so he didn't fancy the,
I think, you know, because I went on with his cousins, and I think they were there to go on with me specifically.
Yeah.
You know, and I was at the stage then when I was training with anybody.
Yeah.
You know, I'd not long finished competition, so so I think I was still kind of pretty much top of my game. And I think it was a bit too, yeah. I mean, I'd like to think that it was just a little bit too, I mean, we watched him go in with the people that were, I mean, some of the big fighters, didn't we, you know, and they.
Yeah, but they didn't know what was happening. They didn't know what was happening on the ground.
Exactly,
and it was
my point. You know,
I mean,
they just didn't know what was happening.
There's an alternative reality, another universe somewhere where you onboard Royce Gracie in the mid-90s.
It's not true.
In an alternative universe, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, yeah.
Somewhere else in the multiverse that happened, and it's a, you know, this massive part of multiverse
it's
jiu-jitsu
amazing,
history.
Isn't it? You know,
that's cool.
I mean, actually, there were rumors that, you know, that we did fight each other and stuff like that. And
really?
Yes, there were, and it wasn't true. That's why I just jumped on that. There,
I just said
no, you know, no. But I mean, and there was a lot of respect in there, but you could tell. You know, we're talking about persona.
Yes.
And he definitely had his cousins were really very relaxed, and he had this persona, and I was totally oblivious as to the possible reasons that he was there. Well, why turn up, you know, to one of my seminars? But anyway, that happened.
That's fascinating.
Great story.
So so then jiu-jitsu was on your radar from then.
Absolutely.
So,
yes.
So you know, you were aware of jiu-jitsu from its origin, essentially on its, you know, when it came out to the rest of the world in the UFC 1. Just from your perspective, and then we'll talk about judo a little bit more, but just from your perspective, how has jiu-jitsu changed in those last 30 years?
I think that if you look at the popularity now, the amount of people doing it, and you know, you've got a massive base now of people training it to a high level, and I think that you know, that just progresses all the way through, you know, the levels. I think that it's gone from being a sport that had, I don't know how many million people, but I mean, you know, it's worldwide now probably the most practiced martial art, you know, and you know, it's, I think that it's the amount of people, but also the amount of good, you know, I think also, and I'm going to say this, right? I think also the fact that the grading system, I don't want to go too much on this, because I feel about this. I mean, you know, the, some of the grades that are given out judo-wise, you know, are just ridiculous. And they, you know, they haven't got the grading system, you know, the, it's kind of gone awry.
Yeah.
I think that with the jiu-jitsu, the black belt has always been something that is really difficult to get, you know, and they've kept the quality of the black belt. Although I have heard that certain places, you know, certainly it's
starting to slip.
Yeah, it's starting to slip a little bit.
I mean, yeah, I mean, we won't go too deep into the whole judo grading system, everything, but I mean, obviously the grading criteria between the two martial arts is really day and night. Judo's this thing where you get it very quickly and then, you know, you get it really fast, and then it's all about, you know, how far within that spectrum of a black belt you are. Whereas in jiu-jitsu, traditionally, it's been a long, you know, 8 to 12 years to get your black belt. But I don't know how much of that is a kind of a philosophy about grading so much as it may just be how long the sport's existed for. Because entropy is something that is bound and, you know, is destined to happen within anything. The first black belt that given out is the benchmark, and then the second one might be higher and the third one might be lower. And the more data points you have, the entropy is going to increase and it's going to get wider and wider apart. So if you ask anyone, the quality of black belts has been watered down in jiu-jitsu over the last 5 or 10 years. But how could it not? When we had the first ever UK black belts were like in the mid-2000s. You know, we're only 15 years out from that, a little bit more than that. In 20 years' time, we're going to have thousands and thousands of black belts. How can it not be watered down? Yeah. So who knows? It might start to become... I think it would be a really long time. I think that there is a difference in mentality and philosophy regarding the belt system in jiu-jitsu, where it's never going to become something that you can get in a couple of years, but it's no longer something that is almost impossible for most people. When I started training, my instructor was a blue belt, and I thought if I train really hard, I was 14 when I started. If I train really hard, I might get my blue belt by the time I'm 20. That was the level at that time.
And a black belt was
here. Inconceivable. Like, I want to get a black belt before I die. You know, that's what it was. Whereas nowadays, someone will come in and you'll be pretty confident that if they train hard, they'll probably get a black belt, you know, within a decade of not taking it super duper seriously.
I think that the same happened with the judo as well. It's kind of, you know, lost its level, and you're right, you know, I think that there's so many, you know, obviously the increase in numbers, and it kind of gets watered down. And the grade for me is probably the least important thing for my judo side of it, you know, and yet it's, you know, it is the most important to a lot of people.
Yes.
Because it is, you know, for me, an indicator of level is being able to get out there and demonstrate to you what I want to show you, you know, and actually when you grab hold of somebody, you know, immediately, and I think that's the thing for me, is that I would like to see the level go back up. I'd like to see it more difficult to get to the higher grades. I think that as with any kind of university course, and let's say they're the highest kind of levels of judo, you know, like from sixth degree black belt upwards, it's got to be university. Absolute university. People talk about masters. I don't know many masters, I've got to say, right? But anyway, you know, when we're talking about the higher grades, then we're talking about university levels. They've got to know they've got to know their stuff.
Yeah.
They've got to be able to break it down. They've got to understand, but they've also got to be active.
Mm.
And, you know, if somebody hasn't been active, you know, I get a lot of people say, oh, he's been in judo for 40 years. I'm saying, no, he hasn't. He hasn't been on the mat for 25 years, you know, but he's, you know, I've been eating for 64 years, you know, but
yeah. Doesn't
and
mean
actually,
anything,
I'm still not very good at it. You know what I mean? My wife says my diet's rubbish. That's it. But, you know, if you think of it that way, you know, you know whether you're contributing or whether you're still contributing. And I think that any degree course, if you can't complete the degree course, you only get graded up to a certain bit.
Yeah.
You don't get the full lot because you've been active, you know, or been there roundabout, or because you're a nice guy, or because you've just reached 50.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I feel like there's this, and we have that in jiu-jitsu as well, where it's this mentality of we can't not, you know, he's been training for this amount of time. Yeah, he's not the level, but we can't just not ever give it to him. And I kind of think, can't you?
No,
I
agree.
Is everyone, if they really aren't doing what they need to do, whether that's something that, I mean, it's just not for them, or they're refusing to put in the deeper work, they're refusing to do the homework outside of it. If they're not that level, then they just might not ever be a black belt. And I think that's okay.
You just get to this level. And that's what I think. You know, and
I agree.
I just think that has to be, you know, it's the same. You wouldn't even question it if it was a degree course.
Yeah.
You did a degree course and you don't finish your last semester.
Yeah. And you you know, he's probably never going to be good enough to pass the course. We should just give him a diploma anyway.
Well, he's a nice guy. You know what I mean? Let's give it him.
Completely agree.
I'm glad. I said, let's not get started on this path and along the path we went.
Really. Okay, I'll move us on with
it. Love
it. Because there's another thing you said there that I thought was really interesting. And because I don't know if you're right, but I don't know if you're wrong. And that is that Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu is the most popular martial art in the world at the moment. It definitely feels that way. It certainly feels that way for me because I'm within it. But I'm not sure it is. So my question to you is, do you know how many people are doing judo in the country?
In the country, probably, I don't know, about 40,000. You see, the problem is you've got people that are registered and people that are not registered, you know, so the amount of people doing it, it's not always a proper indicator. But, I mean, we've got more countries doing judo now than ever before. We had 140 countries at the Olympic Games doing it. So worldwide, judo is definitely very, very popular. But when it comes to the amount of people doing it, you know, within those countries, that's what it's about, is getting the interest within those countries. And also, and I've got to say this, you know, jiu-jitsu has its value. You know, people hold what the teachings and the people that come, you know, they hold the value, you know. And I think that one of the problems is that judo people want it for nothing.
Yes.
You know, they want, and when you're dealing with that kind of mentality, it makes it very difficult, you know, especially us. I mean, we're trying to do a professional job and trying to offer things that people need, we know they need, and you're fighting against the YouTube mentality.
Yeah, that's, I mean, just to kind of give my piece, and I have no idea whether there's more people, because I would intuitively feel like there's, when I think of jiu-jitsu, I think of big businesses with hundreds of students, and I just don't see that in judo. I still think that judo probably has more participants worldwide, just because of how historically embedded it is in so many countries, especially places like France, and I mean places like, you know, in Russia and elsewhere when it's really popular. But the second thing that you said about people wanting judo for nothing, this is something that I've always noticed within judo, and it's a massive difference between judo and jiu-jitsu, which is people just, I don't know whether it's judo's a little bit more community driven, or because of some of the subsidies from Sport England and stuff like that, but people who come from judo expect to pay their £5 for the class, and they go to a jiu-jitsu club, and I mean, you would expect to pay £20-30, sometimes more. If you go to the States, you could be paying $100 for a class, you know, if you're just dropping in. And I think that it allows the much higher amount of money that is expected to be paid in jiu-jitsu allows jiu-jitsu to be more professional and to be run more like a business compared to judo. Is that your experience?
I think that that's probably not far off the mark. You know, I think that from professional point of view, the president of the International Judo Federation, Marius Wieser, has done the most amazing job. I mean, he's professionalized the presentation of judo so much so that, I mean, every Grand Prix, Grand Slam, World Championships, Olympic Games, everything that we do is we have the same crew that, you know, it looks the same. It's professionally put over. It's, you know, the down to the commentary from the, you know, the presentation of the where the cameras are and the, you know, everything about the whole thing, the people organizing the events, they've got it down pat, you know, and it's at a place that it's never been before, you know. And I just wish that the judo fraternity would value it. I mean, it's one thing, isn't it, that, and I think one of the problems is, you know, I'm a volunteer, you know. Yeah. I volunteer my time. I love the kids. I would do anything for my kids. I'm in a place that, you know, an area with, you know, the kids can't afford, you know. Okay, so there are certain things that come in, you know, and I think that we have to cater for those. We cater for the African countries and we cater for the people that can't afford it. But we also, we have to have a professional.
You need to value yourself.
We have to have value. We do. And it's not just about the volunteers. We need the volunteers, but we need the professionals as well. We do. You cannot, you know, people that are doing it professionally are not to be outlawed just because they're doing it for money, you know, because they're doing it for money, but professionalizing the sport.
Yes.
And I think that's important.
Yeah, I just feel that in judo, it's almost considered dirty to want to make money.
Yeah.
Whereas in jiu-jitsu, it's expected. You want your instructor to be full-time. You want them to do nothing else apart from jiu-jitsu because that's, you know, you want, if you want to learn, when you go to university, you want to get a degree, or if you go to hospital and you want to see a doctor, you don't want them to be volunteering. You want them to be 100% full-time, making a comfortable living.
100% number one guy. Yeah, absolutely. And I think that is so important that we keep that mentality, you know, or, you know, that we have that mentality.
Yeah.
Like you say, it's got to have a value.
Yeah, absolutely. Anyway, I mean, I feel like we could talk about 1,000 different things, but we still haven't even spoken about you going to the Olympics yet. So I feel like if I don't talk to you about the Olympics at least once in this episode, then I'm going to get shouted at. So, I mean, you weren't the first British male to win a Olympic medal.
No, I wasn't. Brian Jacks and Angelo Parisi and Dave Starbuck, they were the first ones to win Olympic medals. I was the first one to win two Olympics, you know, two finals. But, you know, the Olympics, funny event for me, you know, in as that, not funny, ha-ha, either. It was an event that never quite went my way. I was favourite for both of the Olympic finals that I did.
Because you were world champion at the time.
I was world champion, and then, you know, the I wasn't world champion for the 81s. The 81s, it was the month before I fought Ezio Gamba in the final of the European Championships, and then I fought him a month later in the final of the Olympics and lost on a split decision. So Beat him in the first one.
And lost
the split decision in the final of the Olympics. And so that was the first one. And then the second one was a mistake, really. And I think that Frank Vinicker, who is a wonderful man, you know, he wasn't expected to you know, do what he did. And I had a really difficult, totally different run-up of the Olympics. Like, I was struggling a little bit off. My form wasn't quite there, but I was on one of those days where it was just knuckle in and get the job done. And so I got through to the final, and I beat all the Frenchmen in the quarterfinals called Michel Novak, one of the strongest men on earth. And anyway, so I beat him in the quarters. And semi-finals through the semi-finals, but it wasn't quite as I was, you know, it was one of those days where I was going to be glad it was all over. And then I fought Vinicker, who was an unknown German. I'd fought him in the Europeans just prior and beaten him. But I thought, well, he was good. You know, he was bad. But I mean, if it could have been a not a dream final of an Olympic Games, but it was one that I would have, you know, definitely wanted.
Yeah.
And then was winning quite comfortably three quarters of the way through, and then stopped on the edge of the area, and then he came in for a throw and caught me on the edge, and just. Again, it was an Olympic silver medal, you know. Yeah. So I always look at it as I lost the Olympic golds, you know, didn't win the Olympic silvers. It's a bit odd.
Yeah. And I guess that just comes from the competitive mentality that you have, you know, that, I mean, so many people, and I do hope that you see your Olympic silvers as the huge achievements that they are, opposed to seeing them as failures.
Losses, yeah. I do now, you know, I mean, I realize that, you know, I mean, I think when you, on reflection, you know, I mean, I had nightmares about it. I did, you know, because I could have just finished my career on a real, that would have been all right. That would have been, I mean, there was other events, you know, where I was in different events that decisions went for me rather than against me, you know, and a bit fortunate.
It happens both ways,
it
right?
It does. It happens both ways. And yeah, on reflection now, you know, you reflect. And I always look at people when I am commentating, always look at, see how people react when they lose.
Yeah.
Because you can normally see, you know, because actually somebody said to me one time, you know, you need to change your persona. That British Open that I lost, devastated, this where I got strangled, and I couldn't look at anybody, you know. I remember looking down, and a guy called Brian Perriman came up to me, a friend at a judo club, and he said, you've got to get your head up, and you have to stand on that rostrum, and you have to shake his hand, and you know, it's really important, he says, because people are watching. Right.
What and why did he say, because it shows weakness, or
because people we had it where there was a really good woman fighter, 48 kilograms, from the Ukraine. And she has a really bad persona. She lost a match and really didn't carry it off well at all. And people picked up on it, you know, immediately picked up on it. And to the degree where only talked about the way she lost, not the fact that she lost.
It's like Ronda Rousey.
Yeah,
you thought, exactly, I mean, the same. I mean, who should have gone down as one of the, you know, certainly,
and
in her
hasn't.
Time, fantastic. She really is just remembered for, and obviously it was also because she was so sort of bombastically overconfident, and that was great. Yeah. When you're winning, it's like Conor McGregor. When you're winning, the ego is fantastic, but as soon as you lose, it's a reason to hate you. And it was, she took that loss so badly. And that's the one thing that you have to say about, for the most part, with Conor McGregor, when he's taken his losses, he's taken them pretty well.
I watched him last night. We were watching him, and with his documentary, he's got a documentary on there. Yeah. And I was really surprised.
Yes.
When he went into his changing room, he went, listen, guys, no excuse. I lost.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I, you know, and he did take it well. He stood there. And I always look at that because I think that's important. And I remember, you know, the disappointment. There's nothing like the disappointment of losing a match like that. You know, that's a big one to lose.
Yeah.
You know?
But you don't want to be remembered as a bad loser.
No. And, you know, so I'm not. So I'm kind of half put it right, you know. And I think also being humble is so important. I think people remember that. They certainly remember if you're not.
Yeah, it's almost that. Yeah, character seems to be something that people actually remember more about than achievements a lot of the time, I feel. I mean, achievements, without achievements, you know, there may be less reason to remember, but a character kind of gives context to what you achieve, right? If you've achieved amazing things, but you've been of questionable character or morality, then the legacy's tainted a little bit. And it could be the opposite if you have that character.
Well, we had an Italian guy And he got to the final of the, well, he wasn't even going to qualify for the Olympics. He was the last person to qualify for the Olympic Games, came in as an outsider, went to the Olympics full, absolutely full of himself, you know, and so as a commentator, you know, I'm just kind of half hoping he gets taken.
You're not meant to, but secretly, yeah.
But he went to the Olympics, tough draw. Gets right the way through to the Olympic final, comes out, throws the guy. Olympic final, wins the Olympic title, throws a back somersault in the, just completely unethical, right? So I'm commentating.
So celebrating that you're not. Yeah. Do you have a rule in judo against that?
Yeah, you can't do it. Yeah, absolutely. You know, so everybody's angry, don't know how to punish an Olympic champion.
Can't really DQ him. It's going to look pretty bad on the Olympic
really
stage.
Show the respect, you know, to his opponent, although he did bow and did show his. And I thought, anyway, so that kind of put him on the wrong foot with me. And then, I saw him at an event. He was one of these with the attitude. He was just kind of beat the world, you know.
Yep.
And he went to Japan about a month later, thinking he was going to do this Japan Grand Slam and just do the same. And he got his backside kicked, you know, so bad. But he took it, just smiled, bowed. Really? Yeah, so humble. And went up in my estimation by about a million.
You it
know
is.
What I mean? And he just absolutely carried it off. Interview afterwards, just had it handed to me.
Yeah.
You know, and he was just great. And he's a really nice guy.
Yeah.
Really lovely guy, just full of confidence and, you know, threw the back somersault in the final. Shouldn't have done that, but.
Yeah. Otherwise, otherwise, decent guy.
He knows who he is as well.
And I mean, since you mentioned it, another place that I have to talk about, but one I have been fortunate enough to go to, is Japan. Of course, you know, Japan is the origin, the home of judo. When was the first time you went out to Japan?
16. So wow. I was 16. The first time I went to Japan, I was 16 with the British team, right? Wow. So because of the result that I had in this British Open.
Sure.
So no 16-year-old traveled with the senior British team. So I'm away with the senior British team and we're going to all these universities, and the universities, you know, I mean, you just go there and it's nonstop, get your ass kicked, you know, but I kept getting up. Right.
Yeah.
And I remember we were training and there was this one fourth year student, like, was really strong and a gold tooth. He had a gold tooth and he handed me, you know, he gave me a bit of a lesson and get a bit of a touch. And I was talking to him, you know, I just kept going back to him through the month that I was there, you know, saying, I am coming for you, you know, I'm going to come and I'm going to, and I'll keep coming for you. And I chased him. He's in my book, right? First book I ever wrote, Gold Tooth. And so I went back every year or every 6 months that I went back to Japan, I was progressing fast. 17-year-old me was a bit different than 16-year-old, and then so he was still kicking my ass at 17 as well. But by the time I was 18, or it was 2 years later when I had this really close one with the Olympic champion, right, totally different. So I was on him, you know, this guy, and I just wanted to kick his.
He was a local there, yeah.
He was a local at one of the universities there. He was, in fact, it was the police dojo. It wasn't the university. It was a police dojo. It was Keisho University. So when I went then, he was then one of the staff the later years. Anyway, so this one time I went, so I think it was 20. I was 20 years of age. And I was onto the juji at the time, and I was really starting to really get it. And so they created their own groundwork competition in this, you know, like, because they wanted to see how I was. So I got.
They created it for you?
Yeah, they did it, especially for me, right? So I got two of them back. And so then they kept sending them. And so I see him, right? So Gold Tooth there was standing there, you know. And so I wanted him. I only wanted him, you know. And all I wanted to do was just rip his arm
him.
Out. I just wanted to rip his arm out so badly. Anyway, he took the bait. He was in, and I managed. I got it, but I thought, I'm not going to put it on too quick. It's going on slow. And anyway, that was that rested that. That finished it. That was just, you know. And then immediately I arm locked him. I said, "No, it's finished. No, enough, no more."
Yeah.
That was it. So, so Goldtooth, I got him in the end. But it was like I had him imprinted in my brain,
yeah.
This guy.
I just love the idea that you know, between the every 6 months you're back home just training your ass off.
For him.
With Gold, yeah. Was that genuine in the game?
Genuine. I think you know me well enough now as well. You know, there's no bullshit there. You know, this guy imprinted himself on my brain because, you know, he was just... And he was a bit of a bully, you see. He was a bully. And, you know what it's like in martial arts. You don't... People don't like bullies.
No. And it's that's something that sort of... kind of creating a motivation in your head. Is that something that you've done... in other, you know, throughout your career? And if so, is that something that you think is really important?
I think you've got to, you know, you have to have, like, have that,
not just the vague aim of winning a tournament, but I just want to beat Goldtooth.
Yeah, I want to beat Goldtooth. I want to, you know, how do I train for, like I say, I was always about preparation and always about getting, I always did my homework, you know. So, like, video analysis was kind of at early stages, you know, but I did my video analysis. I did my analysis on people. I knew exactly, I used to write notes down. I know exactly, you know, when I went in the second time, totally different than first time.
I'm going to, like, I just, like, have this thing in my mind now, as you said that, about having your gold tooth. And I'm going to use
that. I think
we've
all got that gold tooth.
No, but we do.
Tooth,
but it's just, we all have that gold tooth. And actually, you know, in the future, I'll be telling that story in a shortened version and saying, you've got to find your gold tooth, whatever it is, to win this tournament, to beat this person, to prove this, to do that. We all need a gold tooth.
I think we have to direct our, you know, direct ourselves in a certain way, you know, the way we do it. I think, you know, sometimes we can lose it, can't we? You know, it's like when you... you're in a fight that you're desperate to win, and you're so desperate that you know, like I said to you about when I fought the Olympic champion that time, and he came out to this junior, and I looked like a junior at the time, you know, and my judo gi was a little bit too big. It was, you know, and his was made. I remember there's a picture of us actually fighting each other, and I've got this thing that's a bit too big, and I just don't quite look as professional as he does.
Yeah.
And he got desperate. You know, and I think, you know, because and the more desperate you get to finish it, you know, the more it can go away from you.
Yeah.
You know? And I think that's why sometimes you have to keep composed and you have to keep it directed and you have to, you know, set your mind on something. Like my wife said, Nikki said, you know, sometimes my mindset was an absolute curse because it was just, you know, it worked against me. Sometimes.
But I think that most people who achieve greatness, the thing that drives them to greatness can also be something that is a curse in its own way outside of the sport, career, that particular industry or path, because it's something that is extreme. You know, you need this extreme attribute mentality, and extremity often doesn't cooperate with the normality of the rest of your life.
I think that it affects the rest of your life, doesn't it? You know, and I think a lot of us have found that, you know, that when we've been so directed, you know, and blinkered, then we can't see what's happening around us, you know. Yeah. And I think that, you know, I've certainly the last 25 years, you know, I've become a much better person, you know, just a lot more relaxed and obviously still certain things that I'm really directed with, but you know, things are in my life now that are important to me are different to the ones that were important to me then. You know, my family are the most important thing to me, you know, and so nothing is more important than that.
Yeah, I think that's a natural byproduct of the aging process, you know. And just one more thing about Japan, because I find Japan in general to be such a different culture throughout the entire country, but of course also in the judo. So what was the experience like first time, or even, you know, throughout your entire experience training in Japan? What were the big differences, and just what was it like there?
I think from a technical point of view, there were so many, you know, for me it was the danger factor. And so when when I'm in control of, so I can train here, I can train with people. Like if I train now with anybody, I've got to have under control. If I was training with somebody like Iliadis now, you know, I haven't quite got control of that and I'm going to get hurt, right? I will get hurt. And I'm not at that stage in my life now. So I think that, when I was training at home, I was in almost total control of what was happening. So I could control when I attacked, when I didn't attack, etc., when I threw somebody in. When I went to Japan, it was totally different in as that I was always in danger of getting thrown.
Yeah.
You know, so their technique is that good that you know, if like one lack of concentration, bang, you know, and you go over. But, you know, the really strange thing is that if I got thrown here, it was like mortified, you know, like somebody caught me, you know, like somebody caught me. And when there, you just, it happened all the time. So you got to get used to it, you know. So actually then it worked to your advantage then. It wasn't such a big thing, you know, just get out there, just be open. And we see it now in competition. I see it a lot, you know, people come out a totally different fight than two people that don't want to lose than two people want to win. Mm. All right. So the ones that want to win are open and they open it up. And from a commentator's point of view, that is what you want to see. You want to see two Tysons coming out there going, you know, hell for leather at each other, because you know somebody's going to get knocked out. You know it's going to happen.
Yeah.
You know, but actually when they come out and it's all defensive and they're playing the edge and they're playing, you know, that's not what you want to see. And the nice thing is when I used to go to Japan is that brought my technique on, because the fear factor was actually made me react in a different way. And then, you know, being afraid of being thrown made me gave me an edge.
Yeah.
And I think that's my biggest lesson, I think, from there, you know, is that they were so good at throwing that and I see it now. Quite often when you see somebody with good technique, it's like, you know, it's like, so from a standing perspective, you know, if somebody grabs you, you go immediately, oh, you know, that's, I feel the danger, you know, I feel there's something going to happen here, just immediately feel it. And so you react, you know, and actually that reaction is what I want.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I want action reaction.
Mm.
And it's the one thing you can't get as a commentator looking at something. You see a picture, all right, and you go, oh, he's going to do something, or you know, possibility here of something happening, all right. But I know immediately when you grip up with somebody, whether you're feeling the fear factor or not, you know, because I felt it, and also so I recognize it, you know. And I say, right, something's going to happen.
Mm.
Watch this.
So you're just looking, when you're watching someone, you're just looking for the small tells to see whether, you know, what they're feeling.
Yeah, it's reading the game, you know. There's two types of commentating. So you commentate what you see, all right, and the commentate what you, so we have commentators, international commentators that can commentate fresh air. They're brilliant. They're amazing.
It's your play-by-play.
Because they're commentating different sports, right? Yeah. But the thing is, right, is that it's like me commentating the 100 metres. Right, so I commentate the 100 meters and they're set up and they're ready to go and in lane 1, 2, 3, 4 and away they go like that. And, you know, but we can all see that.
Mm.
We all know that. But actually what you want to hear is a little bit of the inner game and the inner psychology of how Usain Bolt is setting this up and what's going through his mind and, you know, and the mindset of the, you know, setting up the blocks and what he wants to do is come out the blocks, you know. And actually the inner game, you commentate what you can see, but you also commentate what other people can't see.
Yeah.
And that's what makes it interesting.
Well, you know, this is something that I wanted to, you know, since we've got onto it about commentating, something I'm super interested in talking to you about, because it's something, I mean, I've been commentating for grappling for a number of years. I mean, maybe 7 or 8 years. But then over the last couple of years, I've been doing a lot of commentary for MMA, Cage Warriors, and for Polaris, and more recently, the last year, doing the hosting, presenting of the shows. So as someone who has been commentating for a very long time and is regarded as the voice of judo worldwide, how did you get into commentary?
by accident, really. You know,
I think that's how everyone gets into
it. 1981. I got asked to voice over my own, the very first tape that Fighting Films did. Fighting Films was a film crew that started to make, do it as a hobby, really, you know, certain films. And they said, well, would you just voice it over? So I voiced my own kind of film in 1981. And it was, you know, I'd redo it if I was going to do it now.
Of course.
But, and then they said, well, we're going to make some tapes of certain weight categories and European championships and world championships, and we'll use them and people can buy them as you know, in their own categories and things like that. So I started to do the voiceovers for them. And then realized then that there was a difference between just doing a voice and then explaining what's happening in the fight, you know, and then the commentary kind of started.
So when you say voiceover, you were doing like just explaining, this is the world championship final between blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. I mean, like kind of a narration. It's a kind of part narration. So what he's doing here.
Oh, like a breakdown.
A breakdown of the matches. And then they said, well, let's try and liven it up a little bit. And, you know, so then started to commentate the fight. And of course, as you know, because you've done it, it's not so easy, you know. And of course, the difficulty with judo is that you've got to name the names of the throws as well. That's what catches a lot of the professional commentators out.
I'm not good at that. Yeah. Well, we've got such stupid names in jiu-jitsu. Well, we got stupid names. You have Japanese names, so
the Japanese names catches them out, right? Yeah. And Yoko Otoshi, Yoko Guruma, and Yoko Gaki, you know. There is a technical difference with each three of those, and you've got to recognize it when you see it straight away. And anyway, so I started to get a little bit more animated with it, and then I was, and then realized that I was getting better at it, and then it kind of came from the heart.
Yes.
And I think that's the thing about the you know, people say, oh, you always sound as if you're so enthusiastic. And I said, you know what? I still am.
Yeah.
After all this
you
time,
have to be.
I really love it. You know what I mean? And actually to see something and if it's an exciting fight, you know, if it's not an exciting fight, it's like anything, isn't it? You know, if you're commentating paint drying, you know, it's bloody difficult.
It's really hard.
It's really hard. If they don't want to fight, you know, so you want picture.
You don't want to say, God, this is bad.
No.
So
is Nikki, right? So we were commentating the Commonwealth Games, and there was a heavyweight match, and Nikki and I were together at the Commonwealth Games commentating this, and she's like playing the comic, and she's taken over and totally dominating this commentary, right? So she looks at me, she says, I am losing the will to move. Right, like that.
Do you know what?
I'm saying, you can't say that, we're live, you know, like that.
I feel like, you know what, you don't want to say that sort of stuff because you're meant to be selling the sport. But you know what, sometimes you got to be the voice of the audience, right? And you got to, they want to resonate with you a little bit. So I remember I was one really, really bad match that was terrible on Polaris. And, you know, we're trying to go, you know, but the grip exchanges are intricate. One point I go, this is terrible. We should just drop them tasers or something to make it more interesting because this is just awful. But yeah, it is like that sometimes. Sometimes it's harder to be enthusiastic. Sometimes it's very easy.
Well, we had one girl that you know, she'd done this really, it wasn't even a clever tactical match. It was just, she just took a chance on it, wins a medal, and she's got her arms up, you know, and I just didn't have words for it. You know, it's just, I haven't got words for it.
Yeah.
I find it very difficult. Well, next match is going to be, you know, just on to the next one, you know what I mean? But yeah, she's come out with some crackers. Nikki has stick a fork in me, I'm done. There's another one. She was brilliant.
So you commentate. You commentate for the World Championships, the Olympics,
every event, and the Olympics was the literally all the Grand Prix, Grand Slams. And,
you're the main. You're the main commentator for
myself. We've got a team as well. Sheldon and we've got Loretta and also Dennis van de Geest, who is all former world champions. Yeah. We've got a great team. Effort that we do. Sheldon and I do, obviously we can't do absolutely all the events together, so the major events and the world championships and stuff like that, we're all there, and then Sheldon and I do the finals. And he plays a different game than I do, so I'm the kind of color commentator.
Okay.
He'll introduce the match, and he'll a little bit of the history.
He's doing play-by-play.
Play-by-play. And we just run it differently, and we've got a great team. It works really well.
So I have to ask, ignore all the audience. I don't care about them for a second. I want some top tips from one of the world's top commentators for my own commentary. Just some things that you've picked up over all of the years. Yeah. I mean, how many events imagine how many events you've commentated on?
Well, my tip to you is, because the Olympic Games is the only one. I did 2000 Olympics where I met Nikki, actually. But then I didn't get it for another couple of Olympics. And the Olympics, because it's OBS, which is Olympic Broadcasting, independent broadcasters, the only event that the IJF have no control over is the Olympic Games.
Yes.
So what happens is we went through to them saying, look, we need our own commentator in here. Our best commentator for judo is not there. And they said, well, he's got to be able to commentate other sports. So they came through to me.
So that's
the thing.
Judo Federation said we want our guy in there.
Yeah.
And they said he has to be able to commentate other sports.
Yes, we've got our own commentators that can commentate all sports.
So they're just trying to save a penny.
So they came to me and said, can you commentate any other sports? I said, yeah, of course. What other sports have you got in mind? We said, well, just the fighting sports, And I said, well, And I was just kind of fibbing through my teeth.
Yeah.
So,
who hasn't lied on a resume?
Freestyle, karate, taekwondo, like this.
All of them.
Well, in the end, they came through and said, right, we the Greco-Roman freestyle, we want you to do that. And also the fencing. No problem.
Did you know anything about fencing?
Nothing at all. But the strange thing is the mentality of any one-on-one combat is the same. Attack, defense. You've got a ring or a square or a circle, and it's point system, penalty system, and the mentality is the same.
So you had to read up on the rules.
Oh, of course, yeah. I mean, I did my real research. And I got a really good compliment at the last Commonwealth Games. A wrestler came up and said, you sounded like a wrestler.
Yeah.
All right? That was a really good compliment. And my tip to you is is what I said earlier about, this is where the non-judo commentators always get caught out, right?
Yeah.
So when it comes to the Japanese names, they don't pronounce them properly. Or they try and pronounce what's happening when it's very intricate. So it's a complicated sport, the judo is.
Yes.
But from a tactical and technical perspective, my big advantage with all the fighting sports was that I just got into the mindset of the fighter. All right. So getting to the mindset of a fighter, which you do because you're a fighter, and what you can see, but also what you can't see, the mentality behind what's happening underneath there. Because I want to know what's happening underneath.
Yeah. Like, it brings so much more context, doesn't it?
Mm. When I'm watching the jiu-jitsu, all right, I want to know. I can't see it. They haven't got 1,000 cameras in there, but I want to see what's happening with the hands, and what where the hands are going, and then how the chess part of it unfolds.
Yeah.
So he's four steps ahead, you know, but I want to know the four steps and how he gets into it and then, you know, gets the strangle to finish it off. And I do it from the heart. Because, you know, the enthusiasm, and don't say, I'm losing the will to live.
I reserve that for very, very rare occasions.
I know you're
going to
do it.
I've only done it on all the matches that I've commentated. I've probably done 60 or 70
Anybody
shows.
Say anything
Only
to
just
you?
Once. Yeah, loads of people. Yeah, yeah. You were spot on. That was the only thing that they said. That was the worst match I've ever seen. So, I mean, one thing that I was just interested, because, you know, you mentioned, you know, you're in your mid-60s now. Do you still train?
Every day.
And do in that training, do you do what you would call randori or any form of that?
Some. I've got a, I talked about my Uki, my young guy comes in. He's, you know, pretty high up in British rankings. And he comes in. He's my partner when I'm demonstrating for techniques. So Nikki said... because I run and I do my weights and I do my circuit trainings and stuff like that. Still stay in fairly good shape.
Yeah.
And I'm really glad I do that. And I enjoy doing it, you know. But she said, you need a bit more. You're just, you know, you're craggy. And sometimes I think as fighters, we lose the feel, you know, if we're not doing it. So we demonstrate a lot.
Yeah.
But actually, she said, you need
the reaction.
You need just to feel it a bit more. Mm. So we started to do. So he started coming in and we do just behind closed doors, just some randori. And so, but he's really, if it's a technique that he thinks, your possibility of an injury, he'll just release it, you know. And we do proper randori and we have a great time. Mm. And it really helped. Helped my mindset, and it helped my my reaction to certain techniques as well.
Mm.
And I was amazed how quickly I clicked back in.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
After how long not doing it?
Probably 10 years of not randering properly.
Wow, that's, you know, a not big doing gap. It properly,
big gap, not, you know, but demonstrating high level.
Yep.
So, you know, you go, oh, it's still doing it.
Mm.
But actually getting on there and getting in
against
there.
Resistance, yeah.
So when we started, like 2 minutes, breathing through my backside, you know, like hands on, like proper rendering.
Mm.
2 minutes like that. And within 2 weeks, we were doing 8-4s.
Wow.
You know what I mean? In there.
Yeah.
And giving it some. Brilliant. I loved it. And I love it, you know. So, so I'm still doing it. And I try not to, if I feel that something's a bit missing, you know. So, like, I had a bit of a problem. I was doing a demo with my shoulder. And so, but he said, are you okay for Monday, right? And I can't resist it. So, we're on Monday. So, we're on. It's game on.
I mean, you mentioned it, and it's something that I observed earlier, which is, I mean, you're 64 years old. You're in fantastic shape. You were showing me some stuff earlier when I first came in. You move fantastically still. You must, through all of that experience, it's surprising when someone gets to their mid-60s and is still able to move, let alone still continue to do it. And when I say that, it's not because they're in their mid-60s. It's because in your case especially, you've started at 8 years old. You know, so you're talking many, many decades of training. But not just training at the highest possible level of competition for many, many years. So you're having to beat your body up. You know, we're used to seeing in sportsmen, in athletes, the sacrifice they make to compete at the elite level in their prime is the trade-off they get for their body breaking down as they get older. You're not only in good shape for someone who has competed at the highest level, you're in great shape for someone who hasn't competed at the highest level. So you must have some massive tips through your experience of, you know, ways to keep that longevity as you age.
I think that good technical base with whatever you're doing. So if you've got a good skill level, you can get away with murder if you've got good skill level. So the skill level is important, and then just keep a good base condition, you know. And I mean, I've had hip operations and knee operation, and you know, I use it as a motivation to get back into shape.
Yeah.
And actually, one of my motivations is to be able to demonstrate, you know, we're talking about the gradings and the guys that stand in there on, you know, with their high grades and don't do anything,
yeah,
really, you know, and I didn't want to be one of them.
Yeah.
You know, I want to be able to get you and feel it, you know. And I was in Lithuania last week and had one of the big former Lithuanian heavyweight fighters, you know, and we're doing the jujigatami and stuff. But, you know, great that I can still go on and show and still able to, you know, because actually the physical feel of it is totally different than just looking at a picture.
Yes.
You know what I mean? It's just totally different. I remember I went to China one time and I had the whole Chinese national men's and women's team there. And so I'm doing this seminar. So I did the juji on one of them, ended up having to do it on every one of the Chinese.
They wanted to feel it.
They wanted to feel it. They just wanted to feel it. And I was knackered at the end. My forearms were blown, you know what I mean? But like,
how many people were there?
Well, there must have been 20 of the Chinese national team that one after, and they kept coming up one after another, you know, no respect, just typical of China, you know, like that.
Yeah.
Just the, and anyway, so I ended up arm locking 20 of them, you know, just so they could feel it.
Yeah. Yeah, I've run around at seminars a few times, squeezing a few people just so everyone can get a good feel of it.
But it makes a difference, doesn't it? What a difference that makes, you know what I mean? And sometimes, you know, and I do the same. We got a really top World Olympic champion Korean, you know, and like just wanted to feel what it like when he threw, you know, just great thrower, you know what I mean? I mean, Kashiwazaki as well, who was a lightweight Japanese guy. I mean, he was just magical, you know, like some of the stuff makes it look very, very easy. And I just wanted to feel it, you know.
That's it,
you know, just want to feel it because it's different.
It is. I mean, you can explain everything. You can break it down as much as you like, but there's something about, yeah, but let me feel that. Oh, now I get it.
Got it.
It's almost like when you explain something, doesn't matter how good the language is, how good the breakdown is, which is kind of what teaching is all about, you're never going to be speaking the language of the other person's body.
And also, I think this is the animalistic kind of, you know, it's like if you got somebody good on top of you and they're digging in, you know, the power aspect of the whole thing is something that you can't explain.
Yeah.
Until you've, you know, you just feel it, and then you think, fuck, you know, no wonder the arms come out, you know what I mean? Just, or no wonder they get their strangle every time, you know. It's a bit like Roger, you know, with his thing. He's relentless, you know, for the catch.
Yes, feeling Roger's mount. Not something that I, not something that is particularly enjoyable.
No.
But something you want to feel just once.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, exactly. You know, and I, you know, and you notice that, you know, why does he get it so much? But everything, you know, he's 6'3", 6'4", and everything working together, you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
To make it work.
And, you know, you're saying you still teach a huge amount of seminars. Kind of the main work that you're doing around judo is the commentary stuff, the teaching, and then the courses and online stuff.
Yeah, we have like NA Effective Fighting is a resource. We've got a resource of all of the first 40 throws. All broken down into minute details, 7-minute films, and then, you know, we did that originally, and we thought, right, okay, so that's a resource, and then we thought, well, we'll make some different videos that will, each of the individual videos will do some special studies of those, and they're 2 hours a piece, you know, so they kind of not just my way of doing it, but other ways of, you know, so different development.
Do you look at the way that other people do it?
Look at the way other people have done it and how they've developed it and how it's kind of gone on to their pathway. And so, and that makes it really interesting for me, because then a study becomes not only a study, that people can access, right? But it comes a study for me. It increases my repertoire as well, you know. And so we did that. But then when we looked at that, the important thing was not necessarily the individual techniques, but the understanding. Like when it comes to throwing somebody over, if you see good throwers, they have good movement, good balance, good direction, good adjustment. You know, they have fantastic hands and their whole body's working, you know, and you look at it and you see somebody that is a really good thrower. They'll throw somebody so hard with minimum effort. You know, and it looks like that. And it's because everything's working together. So actually what we did then is created a part that people can access of how to move and how to get direction. And so that comes first, and then the learning of the technique comes second.
Yeah. And as you're saying that, you said the following words, you said good hands, which immediately made me think of the final question I'm going to ask you, which is another question just for me about grip training. Because Obviously judokas are renowned for their grip. We were moving around a little bit earlier and you have some of the thickest wrists that I've ever felt, especially on someone of your size who's not huge, but like wrists that feel like, you know, you've got a metal band strapped around them. Obviously, a lot of that just comes from training. But I know that, I mean, the interesting thing with judo that wrestling has it, judo definitely has it even more so, I'd say. Jiu-jitsu doesn't have it because it's this weird amalgamation of so many different styles. But there's this culture of strength training for judo and grip training. So in all of the years that you've been in the sport, any grip training exercises just to kind of satisfy my own interest in that?
The thing is about gripping is that you don't grip for the sake of gripping.
Yes.
So it's not just about, you know, having strong wrists and reducing the lactic buildup in your wrists and stuff like that, because it's the first thing that goes.
Yeah.
But it's to dominate grip. So like the difference is that if you're fighting a world-class judoka standing, all right, so you come out and so if we do judo rules, all right, so your aim is to get me down to ground, because that's where your chance is, right? Okay, because you're not going to throw me, right? I'm not going to let you throw me. But the point is that my advantage will be the grip.
Yeah.
So I'll stop you going down. All right, so
I'll be doing the butt scooting and moving towards you thing that you spoke about earlier.
Right? And then and judo rules, you'd get penalized for that. But If we switched it over then and put it onto jiu-jitsu rules, totally different, right? Okay, totally different. And a different result at the end, for sure, you know, because I'd have to change my strategies completely then. But then, you see, the gripping is all about, there's no substitute actually from gripping somebody's jiu-jitsu.
Yeah.
And they you know, they're pulling to get you off. So everything I used to do was against somebody pulling this way out of my, so it's not just about doing wrist curls to you know, so doing that and doing that are two different things.
Yes.
All right. So you actually need to build up the resistance from somebody pulling fingers. So actually, my fingers are stronger.
Yes.
Than the wrists. Actually, you know, but it's a mixture of the two. So it's wrists and fingers, but it's important that you do it more specifically with a judo jacket if you can, and with the intention of throwing from the dominant grip. So the rules now state in judo that if you've got a dominant grip, you have to attack from it. So I can get a dominant grip on you.
You have to attack.
You have to attack. Yeah. So if I get a dominant grip on you and I just stop you from coming in, all right, then I'll get penalized.
That's interesting.
Yeah, I have to attack off it. So this is a really good. It's a good aspect of the new modern rules, because otherwise the grip fighters, we just train for grip fighting to dominate you.
So you can't do anything.
No. Yeah. I just block you out and I stop you. So now if I get you, if I've got a dominant grip, then I use the grip to attack immediately.
Yeah. Well, Neil, I feel like I could sit and talk to you all day long, and maybe even in the future we do another episode. We've done over 2 hours now already, flown past. I just want to thank you very, very much for having me in your lovely house and for sitting down and chatting to me.
It's been my pleasure. Honestly, it's been great. Thank you very much.
No, my absolute pleasure. Thank you. That is it, guys. I hope you enjoyed that episode. If you want to find out more or follow Neil, then you can check out his Instagram page, which is at Neil Adams Judo. You can also check out his website, which is neiladamsjudo.info. He's got loads of stuff on there, including all of the instructionals and stuff like that. If you want to upgrade your judo, learning from one of the best to ever do it. If you want to follow myself, then you can, as always, find me on Instagram. My handle is at @raspberry_ape. If you want to follow just the podcast page, then that is at @raspberryapepodcast. My website is raspberryape.com. You can check out my YouTube, which this video of this podcast, if you're not already watching it on there, is on. That is youtube.com/raspberryape. As always, if you've enjoyed this episode, please feel free to share it. Tell your friends, tell your family, tell everyone who wants to listen. And if you want to go ahead and write a review on iTunes or Spotify, that would be greatly appreciated. Hope you enjoy this episode, and I will catch you next time. Take it easy.